And down below, you can either disable or keep it going. You just have to go over to it and then you can automatic captioning.
Okay.
Yeah, just under more. Should show recording for one, top right, very top.
Yeah, so
Intro.
the recording's already in going, so I
Yeah,
think that's
that's
good.
what you want. Okay.
Yeah.
And the caption should be under English.
And that's
Yep.
English. We're good.
Cool.
Nathan, are you able to hear me?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yeah, and the audio in the room is good.
Excellent.
And
All
then
right.
just double check. It looks like you have it under the laptop. We can put the video for this if you'd like. It's up to you. It's under video. If you
Sure.
click, it doesn't matter.
Logitech meetup, I'm
Yep.
assuming.
Just click on that and it switches over.
Okay. Yeah, that seems good. All right. Let me test the screen share. And then maybe I'll just do the application window so it'll hide the zoom controls.
Yeah, and then they
And then the
said
Control Alt
Control
Shift H to hide zoom controls. And then I. Okay. Oops,
think
but
I clicked on that.
yeah, okay, and then double check in and go through that. All right, I think we're good.
On those mics, you'll see it on the front. I don't know if you saw that yesterday. You just click it up or down. Up.
That's still on.
Yep. And then it's about 2 or 3 seconds it pulls up.
Cool, I think I'm all set then. Thank
All
you.
right. Yep, you're welcome.
All right, let me make sure I can get to the chat. Cool. Yeah, and then I'll be able to handle chat here.
I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to hear any questions. I don't know if that's piped into Zoom.
So there is a microphone. Let me go over to the microphone and turn it on and test it.
Okay.
All right, so now I'm over at the microphone. That's
Oh, I hear you just fine.
right, and I think Damien plans on joining the session, so I think he's going to help and pass out the mic when it comes to question time.
Excellent.
Oh, I'll just leave this in. Watch him.
Cool. How have things been so far?
Yeah, it's been really good. I went to a couple of ViewFind sessions and saw how other people are running their ViewFind instances. Most of them hosted by like index data, not self-hosting. So it's interesting to see how others are doing it.
Yeah, I've noticed that before. I guess it if you don't have the IT people available to host it, because as we know, it does take commitment.
Right. That was the issue that they didn't have IT on hand to do it themselves. It was also interesting because they were still linking to the EDS instance.
Oh, so they're not using the EDS module in ViewFind.
Right.
That would have saved them a little frustration last week.
Yeah. Hey, everything is set up. The audio is working.
Okay. Hi, Nathan.
Hey, Damien.
How is it going for you?
It's fine for me. I'm just sitting in my living room.
Conference. You see a lot of sessions?
No, I've been mostly working.
Oh, okay.
My virtual attendance is mostly just this meeting.
Well, you should look at our things. There are lots of interesting things.
Yeah, I might.
So you
Yeah, I'm already in the Zoom. The recording's already
in the
started.
Zoom, you've got the right name in the Zoom.
Just the conference room. That's what it defaulted to, is the name of the conference room. I could change it. I don't know if I need
Oh, okay. So it says like Shawnee.
Shawnee room. Yeah.
Well, that's fine.
And then I tested that mic, turning it on, make sure that the audio worked on that. So I think it's all good.
Okay. You guys are all set up?
We're all set up. We're good.
Okay. Did you get the microphone
Yeah.
to the Shure Digital?
That's the one thing that we always want to double check.
Check that.
Perfect. You guys are wonderful.
Yep.
Awesome. Thank
Thanks.
The recording is stopped right now.
No, it's going. It's just in the more because Zoom. Zoom hiding important things like recording.
At this point, you can just leave it running again.
Yeah, I'm just gonna leave the warning. Control Shift H. Slideshow. And then at question time, we can turn on that mic, and then there's like a 2 second delay from powering it on from when.
I didn't see the mic for my session. I was looking for it and didn't see it. I didn't realize it was back there. So, the actual attendees couldn't hear what people were saying.
Always in retrospect, learn with practice.
So suppose we want to use that. We will take it off.
Yeah, so when it's time for questions, we just flip the power switch on. And then when it comes to this, now the mic is on, test it around.
Okay.
When you test it, they think you hear us now that this is on.
I can do that.
Yeah, good afternoon.
That's the one.
And hope for no Zoom snafus like in the other meeting rooms this morning. So apparently in some of the other sessions this morning, like either Zoom crashed or laptops completely shut down or
Uh-oh.
Yeah, I thought that.
audio was garbled
I'm
and
standing on Windows and Linux, but no, it's not.
Zoom than a Zoom. We'll make it work. It'll be fine.
This morning, last week, I did go to the session about genetics. I'd like to add something to the little. There you go.
Yeah,
who can those reports? Notions. Oh, yes. Sorry, I just remember the question I asked. It was the used by data reporting, like filling out the ACRL survey results, and the presenter had one text file that was like a notebook, like a Jupyter notebook, but not a Jupyter notebook, with both the instructions and the queries in various languages and the return data for every question on the ACRL and several other surveys over a several year period in this one test file. And I was like, is that for reading world? That's a little scary. Yes. Anytime that Hello Max started playing Towers of Tomorrow. Doing better.
Taking a nice smile today.
I like that.
Oh, thanks.
That is awesome. I did a little money for us.
Right, in the interest of time, we'll go ahead and get started. We're right at 11 o'clock. So. Welcome and thank you all for coming to our presentation on advanced deployment strategies. I am Megan Schantz and I've been an application developer at the Michigan State University Libraries for the past 10 years. And more recently, I'm a member of the ViewFind Project Management Committee. I'd also like to introduce Nathan, who is joining us remotely.
Hi, I'm Nathan Collins. I do development and DevOps work, and I've been at Michigan State University Libraries for 19 years.
So over the years, our team has designed, developed, and maintains dozens of applications. In recent years, we've shifted from doing manual deployments to fully automated pipelines. And today we'll explore how we did that for our ViewFind instance and what tools you can use to implement it for yourselves. So looking briefly at our agenda of what we'll cover today, we're going to talk about our personal ViewFind story, the goals we had in mind, the method we used, the infrastructure behind everything, and then the services built on top of that infrastructure. And of course, no, nothing would be complete without the lessons learned going through that whole process. All right, so before we can get into how our ViewFind instance is deployed now and the infrastructure behind it, let's back up to where we began. In July 2021, MSU Libraries went live with Folio and EBSCO Discovery Services EDS, replacing our prior ILS Sierra. Due to limitations of what could be done in EDS, we started investigating a replacement discovery layer that we needed to have done by the end of the year. So we considered both ViewFind and Blacklight, since they both had existing support for Folio. But we decided on ViewFind largely to the large community support, the active community, the extensive configurability, and our team's existing PHP knowledge was also a big boon. In June 2022, our development began on building up our instance. We initially focused on getting the infrastructure in place. We wanted everything solid so we could build on top of that. We were able to do a soft launch of our ViewFind instance right after winter break, so just half a year later, and our site was went live alongside EDS. Over the next couple of months, we built in additional feature requests after users got to see the site and work with it a little bit, and we improved the infrastructure even further after that. And by May, we fully replaced the EDS interface and we're no longer linking to it at all. To have an idea of our scale, we have a wide audience of staff and students, and our library has over 9.3 million records, catalog records, 2.4 million authority records, and nearly 6,000 course reserves in our instances. So the goals, what we need from this. So in order to be able to do the frequent deploys without disrupting users and being able to handle the growing data that we knew to have, we had these following goals in mind. Infrastructure as code. So this is the concept that infrastructure is defined and provisioned in files that are maintained in source control, to build into that next goal of having fully automated deploys. We wanted there to be no manual steps when making changes to our infrastructure or deploying new code other than pushing the changes to the relevant files to our source control software, GitLab. In order to do that, we needed everything to be idempotent. This is the concept that a task will produce the same result no matter how many times it is run. And a number of our tools that we use are inherently idempotent, which we'll discuss more later. Additionally, we wanted our infrastructure and services to be fully redundant to avoid having a single point of failure and improve our reliability and availability of our site. To do this successfully, we needed to have the equality between our development and production environments. Everything that a production site has, our development environments have too, to avoid having to hear, well, it didn't do it on dev. And finally, environment as cattle, not pets. Don't treat environments or servers as unique and irreplaceable. This improves the resilience to failure and provides consistency. So, those goals in mind, we decided to continue working in the way that we have with other large projects using agile methodologies. We had a team of about 4 developers working on sprints that were typically around 2 weeks long. We had planning meetings at the beginning of sprints, daily stand-ups every single day, and retrospective at the end of our sprints, along with review meetings with a small group of stakeholders in the library to get feedback on the changes that we had made. All right, now we're ready to get into the infrastructure that we have implemented, and that's the foundation for all the services. Hand it off to Nathan.
Hi, so infrastructure is core to setting up any large system. That's the virtual machines, the networking, the storage, firewall exceptions, and so on. These often require like requests to several other units, IT tickets, questions about specific needs, and then waiting for the work to get done. Even after this, you may need to do additional configurations like add users, set permissions, install additional packages. And if something wasn't correct the first time go around, you may need to do more tickets. And those changes are now starting from an intermediate state, and the whole process can end up being a hassle. For our public catalog interface, we really wanted to solve for these problems using automation, which means not using our local campus infrastructure. So our Folio instance is being hosted by EBSCO, and they're hosting it in Amazon Web Services, AWS, Region 1. So we requested that it would just make sense to host our public catalog in the same fashion right along Folio in AWS Region 1. And that was approved, so we were in. Now we just had to actually do the work and not fail at it, as this was all pretty new to us at the time. Next slide. So we were now in charge of our own infrastructure completely. We could have manually configured everything as we needed it in AWS Web Console and try to document every step accurately for the many thousands of steps and configurations which would be needed, or we could orchestrate our infrastructure with what is known as infrastructure as code. As the name implies, we don't make our infrastructure ourselves, but rather code what we would like our infrastructure to look like. So we're defining resources, networking, virtual machines, and so on. We declare variables for the memory and the disk sizes and the ingress ports, the whole works. We then use a tool called Terraform, which reads our infrastructure definitions and creates a plan for making those occur in a cloud provider, which in our case is AWS. We let Terraform apply that plan. It goes through and makes all the necessary API calls to provision the infrastructure exactly as we defined it. And the whole process just takes minutes from start to end. And when we want to modify our configuration, we update our definitions and then rerun Terraform. It analyzes what already exists versus the new definitions and makes only the necessary changes. If nothing changes, then nothing happens. And of note, the whole process is idempotent. As mentioned, an action is idempotent if the end result is the same, no matter how many times you run it. So if we tell Terraform that we want to have 100 gigabytes of storage available, it analyzes what we have currently and then resizes our storage to ensure we have 100 gigabytes of storage. If we already had 100 gigabytes of storage, it doesn't do anything. So we can rerun our configuration via Terraform multiple times without any conflicts or any excess resources being provisioned. So what does our virtual hardware setup actually look like? Next slide. So we opted for a cluster of three nodes, each node being equal. So all the nodes are running a slice of every service to support our catalog interface. We use Docker Swarm for running our services and spreading the service replicas across the node. We'll touch more on that later. With three nodes, in the event of an outage of any one or even two nodes, our catalog interface should remain online and available, though perhaps operating a bit slower as it wouldn't be sharing the load anymore. While each node accepts traffic from the public, they all reside in a virtual network, meaning that the internal communication for the nodes is completely private and not routed on the open internet. They also have access to shared storage and email services within the private network. Again, those are provisioned via Terraform. And we actually have two of these clusters, one for development and one for production. This isolates potentially irresponsible developers like myself from accidentally causing havoc during development, which might affect production services. But more importantly, it grants us a safe place to test our infrastructure as code changes before affecting the production cluster. Next slide. Now, Terraform only provisions our resources. Once they are created, we still need to configure our virtual machines themselves. This is accounts and permissions and host services like Docker Swarm. To do this, we use another infrastructure as code tool called Ansible. Ansible is actually what we used to call Terraform originally. So once Terraform is provisioning the hardware is complete, Ansible just proceeds to immediately configuring are those nodes using the Ansible playbook definitions we have. And Ansible's pretty great in that it's capable of running without any pre-setup needed. There's no special client software. It just simply connects and runs commands over plain SSH. And if you follow the recommended practices with Ansible, it is also idempotent. So we run our complete Ansible configuration, including the Terraform provisioning on our cluster on a regular basis. But you might ask, if Ansible runs Terraform, then what runs Ansible? Next slide. Recall the concept of infrastructure as code. Where do you put code? In version control. So at MSU, we use Git for our version control system, and we have a campus-hosted GitLab instance as our centralized code location. GitLab has an included CI/CD system, which we use. CI/CD stands for Continuous Integration and Continuous Deployment or Delivery. So CI/CD allows for automation of actions when you push new code to your version control system. Whenever we push changes to either our Terraform configs or Ansible playbooks, we've configured our CI to perform certain actions. And yes, those CI actions are also code and are also defined within the same Git repository. Anyway, depending on which branch we push our changes to, certain actions are taken. So for the main branch, it starts running Ansible and thus Terraform on our development cluster. If the changes to the development cluster look okay to us, we can then click to proceed to do the same process on the production cluster. For every change we make, the entire process is run from start to finish, and that's why keeping things idempotent is important. The CI system also allows us to inject secret and sensitive data into the process without having to have those things committed directly into our code. That's things like authentication tokens and private keys, passwords. They're all stored separately, and our GitLab CI process inserts those secrets into the Ansible playbook at the CI runtime. But for diving a bit deeper into CI, I will hand it back over to Megan.
Thank you. So looking at an example snippet of our existing infrastructure CI configuration file, you can see here at the top, we're defining a template that can be reused over and over. In this sample, we're defining a template that calls the Ansible playbook, and that's provisioning all those AWS resources we saw on that previous diagram. So when we want to define a new environment cluster, all we have to do is define a new CI job that implements that template. And then define a variable for what we want to call the cluster. So we have these two jobs down here below, one that's called for prod and one that's called for deval. And we're just extending that template to create the cluster. And it's that simple. Anytime we want to make a new cluster, we just extend the template yet again with the new variable. It's very reusable. And then looking at the whole pipeline from GitLab's pipeline interface, we can see how we can easily see what jobs have succeeded and what still need to be run, and which ones are manually triggered, and some run automatically, like the tests at the beginning. All right, now we're ready to see the services built on top of that infrastructure and actually get UFine deployed somewhere. So as we mentioned before, we have fully containerized every service that UFine instance needs to be deployed, and we use it with Docker Swarm, which is a container orchestration tool that manages a group of Docker hosts. So each node in the cluster has multiple environments living on it, but they're totally isolated from each other due to the features of Docker Swarm. So here in this diagram, you can see we have all of the services that a UFine site needs besides just UFine itself. And like we use a scalable version of MariaDB and Solr, as well as some other services that we'll look at a little more closely later. But I do want to draw your attention to Trafic at the end of that list. This is an application proxy that handles all the incoming requests to the server and routes them to the appropriate environment and the service based on a defined set of rules. This service is key to allowing us to successfully manage multiple environments on a single node. And then not only are these services living on a single AWS node, but we have identical containers living on the two separate nodes to prevent downtime. But we'll get into more details about that later. So looking at this pipeline for all the services deployed, it runs automatically for any change to the main pipeline or development branches. So initial checks and scans are run, and we have a job called the set stack name job that determines what environment is going to be deployed to. For example, we have it might be Catalog Prod to go to our production site or Devel Megan to go to my development site. So then, after those tests and initial jobs are run, it will do building of the Docker images, and each image is tagged based on the commit ID. So Every single deploy gets a unique Docker image. It's a fresh set of code for every single deployment. There's no code reuse between them or no overlap. And as soon as the dependent Docker image builds are complete, they'll automatically start doing the deploy steps for the jobs that are ready to be deployed. And the environment that it deploys to is, of course, based on that stack name variable. After all of the deploys for all the services are complete, it'll verify that all of the services are healthy and then run an integration test that we have written for our custom viewfind module. And this is a view of that same exact pipeline, but showing the dependencies that are defined between the jobs to reduce the overall runtime of the pipeline. Every single job can define what jobs had to be run and completed successfully before the subsequent job can even start. So in this example, we can see that in order to deploy our monitoring application, we have to first have the internal network deployed, the Docker Compose files copied to the server, as well as the monitoring image to have even been built. And all of the jobs, of course, depend on that set stack name job that determines what environment we're going to deploy it to. And clicking on any of those jobs will allow you to dive down even further and see the exact commands that were run on our GitLab runner server, which we also self-host. And it'll tell you the exact commands that are run and the output of those commands, which can be particularly useful for when the jobs don't run successfully and there's error being able to debug them. So looking at other ways that we can improve the developer's quality of life, the development environments get the exact same cluster services as the production environments. There's no code differences between the lower and the higher environments. While the CI jobs themselves run the same tasks regardless of the environments, there's a few extra jobs that run only on the development environments. For example, there's jobs that create the DNS entries in AWS for the development environments, pre-populate those development environments with data, and then clean up those environments when we're all done with them. We specifically do not have that remove environment job for the production environment so that there's no accidental clicking and taking down production. We also have all of our environments, including the development ones, set up to automatically request and remove their TLS certificates for HTTPS. And all that's needed to make a new development environment is creating a new branch in GitLab, either from the user interface in GitLab or pushing it via the command line. You'll notice how this process is almost identical to how it worked for the infrastructure side of the CI, which is intentional for consistency. Also, over time, we've been adding more and more scripts that make certain tasks easier for us. For example, if any of you have had to do a full re-import of data into your viewfind instance, you know there's multiple steps involved with it. So we have a wrapper script that'll do all of those tasks for us, report out a summary, and then email us that report when it is complete so that we don't have to sit there and babysit all of the tasks and just keep checking to see if it is done yet. Some other ones we have are a script to locate a specific MARC record through all of the MARC files, and then has the option to extract just that specific MARC record, the latest version of it across all of our files. And then the ability so that we can import that specific MARC record into our development instances. This makes it really easy for us to develop new features and debug problems when we don't want to import the entire record set into our development instances. We just want to test one specific record. And we also have a script to redeploy a specific service for an environment. Another handy one is to be able to connect from a service from any of the nodes in the cluster without having to know which node that it was deployed to. And many of our Docker images have custom diagnostic and management tools directly built into the images themselves. We also have some additional services to make our lives easier, such as Trafic, that application proxy I mentioned earlier, has a routing dashboard to show all of the rules that it has identified and what services that it would route them to. This can be particularly helpful when you're first setting things up and you need to find out why a request isn't going where you think it should. And many of you might already be familiar with the Solr dashboard, which shows you the health of the collections and lets you make direct queries into Solr as well as many other tasks. This one also handy, mail catcher. This is for our development environments only. It catches all outgoing mail instead of actually sending it out. This is particularly useful for when testing changes to the feedback form. So we're not actually sending out emails to other places. We can just capture them and make sure that the email looks like exactly how we wanted it formatted, has all the fields that we wanted, and it looks like it would have sent to the correct people that we expected it to. For example, in our instance, we expect it to send to two separate email addresses every time the feedback form is submitted. All right, I will hand it over to Nathan to talk about how else we can prevent downtime.
Okay, so I wanted to cover some of the mitigation strategies that we've used to avoid service downtime. Downtime can happen for a multitude of reasons, both intentional, like when you're doing upgrades, and unintentional, like a service crash or a denial of service attack. We wanted to try to avoid as much downtime as possible from either of these categories. For example, if you don't keep up on security patches, your nodes could become vulnerable to attacks, which could bring down your services. So we have all of our nodes apply security patches automatically. And as covered earlier, we have three equal nodes in our cluster, and sometimes these nodes require reboots. So we've configured them to automatically reboot when required. But each node has a different time period configured each day when it is allowed to perform that reboot. And this ensures that we keep two out of the three nodes available when these reboots are happening. And I'm going to go into a little more detail on these other bullet points. Next slide. As mentioned earlier, we use Docker Swarm, which is included with the standard Docker engine, to manage our service deployments. So all our major services are clustered or replicated. We have three replicas for our Docker services, and we have the three nodes that they operate on. We've configured Docker Swarm deployments to have the replicas evenly distributed on the nodes to ensure an outage of any given node doesn't affect our availability. Additionally, we've configured Docker Swarm to deploy the updates to our services one node at a time. So new Docker replicas for ViewFind, Solr, and so on are updated on the first node. It then waits for that service replica to come online, verifies it's okay before proceeding to the next replica, and then the whole process again for the third replica. This ensures that the services remain online even when deploying. We frequently deploy new updates to our production catalog with confidence, even during working hours. Next slide. But what if an update for the deployment isn't okay? So you can configure Docker Swarm to handle that. For our production nodes, it just does a rollback to the previous service state. And on deployment nodes, or development deployment nodes, we just have it pause in place, letting us inspect what went wrong. Docker can determine if something is okay via health checks. These are scripts which run periodically to verify a replica status. They are customizable, and we've set up these health checks for most of our services. We have specialized checks which run to determine if a replica is truly online or resyncing data from a peer, or if it's actually had a failure. Likewise, we've written custom startup and shutdown scripts for the more difficult services. For example, we've had to put a lot of work in to ensure our database clusters start and shut down cleanly. This is one of the downsides we've run across with Docker Swarm, is that stateful applications like a database cluster sometimes need some white glove treatment sometimes. Other containerization technologies like Kubernetes have better mechanisms in place to deal with this, but we've made our decisions and we've done pretty well thus far. In part due to how closely we keep an eye on our services. Next slide. There are a lot of components in putting together a working ViewFind instance, even more so when you mix in the clustered services spread across multiple nodes. To better keep tabs on everything, what that's going on, and also to have easy access to diagnostic information, we've created our monitoring app. The monitoring app is a portal to view the overall state of our complete ViewFind deployment, including all of the services. And you can see a very abbreviated selection on the slide here. It also has the ability to show recent log messages and has quick links to our custom documentation that we've written. Beyond that, it tracks a number of metrics that provide graphs for easy visual analysis. And this has been particularly handy in identifying distributed bot crawlers, but more on that in just a moment. But this is not our only system for keeping alert. Next slide. We also employ a service called Nagios, which is entirely external to our catalog. Being an external service, I mean, not even being hosted in AWS, if everything was to go upside down with the catalog or something went wrong in the AWS region, we would still be alerted to the problem. Nagios is an event monitoring and alerting tool, which does frequent checks of our services, our nodes, and even some of the content in our catalog to ensure that everything is operating as we would expect it to. We've built up many dozens of checks and validation routines into our Nagios configuration, going so far as to even get alerts if our error logs suddenly start to grow larger. It's quite nice to get notified of a suspiciously high load on our servers before the help desk calls us, and with Nagios alerting us, we're often able to prevent those calls altogether. But where would a suspiciously high load come from, you might ask? Next slide. When we first launched our public catalog interface, we didn't really have any major concerns about bots. This changed over time. As the race for bigger and better AI models continues, people who wanted more data to train their models on have pushed the boundaries on bot harvesting behavior. From the rapid scanning and distributed crawling, fake and randomized user agents, vastly distributed sources coming from all over the globe, to even placing bots behind VPN IP addresses, we've had to adjust and adapt to this onslaught of aggressive bot visitors. However, we have been firm in our resolution to not have users have to solve puzzles or have that annoying wait 1 second and then click the checkbox CAPTCHA mechanism that you see so often. But we did have to do something. We recently integrated a new open source anti-bot service called Go Away, which sits in front of our Viewfind instance. It's extremely configurable. It includes custom theming and automated challenges to validate that visitors are indeed real. None of the challenges require any user input, and for normal users, the delay is at most 2 seconds the first time you visit the catalog each session. We've also exempted many known good IP sources from ever having to do those challenges at all. So known good IP sources include the Merit Network in Michigan, which MSU is a part of, Michigan government IPs, major national and local ISPs and wireless providers, and some other academic networks as well. We hope to continue to expand on these challenge-free IP ranges as time goes on, but at this point, nearly all of our regular traffic doesn't have to see a bot challenge screen appear at all, and we hope to keep it that way. So overall, what lessons have we learned and what might we have done differently? Next slide. Well, as I just mentioned, having a bot mitigation strategy from the beginning would have saved a lot of frustration. For a number of months, we were playing whack-a-mole with these bots. It was annoying, but mostly effective, at least until they brought VPNs into the battle. Another thing we could have done differently, when we first launched our Viewfind catalog, we only had a single cluster, which is now our production cluster. While we had in our mind that we wanted to treat the development and production as similarly as possible, it really is nerve-wracking to have those two try to live together. Thankfully, we never had an incident, but the separate development cluster makes deployment for infrastructure changes less worrisome. Nowadays, a mistake during development should only disrupt a fellow developer. Next, our desire for the multi-node cluster replicas with equal operation between them. Turns out that there's a lot of complexity to make that setup stable and a lot of edge cases which have to be handled. This is not to say that we regret our design, but we did end up having to put a large effort into making things work well. Somewhat related, using Kubernetes instead of Docker Swarm would have made the number of deployment tasks much easier to complete, but learning Kubernetes is much more difficult than learning Docker Swarm, and we really didn't know much Kubernetes at the time. So we ended up using what we knew, and it turned out all right in the end. It was just a bit bumpy to get there. Lastly, and this one is kind of a never-ending lesson, maintaining our customizations to our Viewfind instance adds a lot of long-term maintenance debt that builds up over time. Each Viewfind upgrade, we have to merge our code with the upstream changes that we're pulling in, and this usually goes okay, but we've had a few minor things break in past upgrades, so we try really hard nowadays to contribute changes and fixes upstream to core Viewfind whenever feasible. Not only does this mean that our upgrade is less of a hassle with less chance for someone here to make a mistake, but it allows other Viewfind installations to benefit from the work that we've invested. And yes, there's a lot of other things that we've learned along the way, but these are just kind of like the major takeaways. For the most part, we're very happy with the end result and the services we've been able to provide. And so thank you and the community as a whole for helping us make this possible. And I will hand it back to Megan to wrap us up.
Great, thank you. So what we hope you take from this is that you don't have to start from scratch and redo your entire infrastructure to benefit from some of the tools that we mentioned here today. Every step that you can automate is one less step that errors could be introduced when you're deploying something to production. And importantly, it gives your team more confidence to do more frequent deployments. And at this time, we'd be happy to take any questions that you have for us. Thank you. Yes, in the back.
Say some words about how you're managing some of the shared sources like the nation buildings in solar. From that slide that was describing nodes, it looks like there are separate MySQL and solar clouds on each of the nodes. So you're ingesting into solar three times.
Excellent question. Okay, so for Solr and RayDB, they have cloud versions that handle this for you. So there's Solr Cloud. So you still ingest it only once into Solr, but then it replicates the data into the three separate nodes. And it'll sync the data across the three separate nodes. So even if one of those nodes goes down, the data is stored on each of those three nodes. It's the same with MariaDB. It doesn't matter which of the three nodes you happen to be connecting to when you're inserting or updating to the database. It will then replicate that data to the other two nodes. And so then when you query and you happen to hit another node, it will have the same data as any of the other nodes. Follow up?
So I think what you're describing is scenarios where there's the potential for multiple readers. Maybe that was possible in some reading.
Yeah, as Nathan wrote it, like some white glove treatment, MariaDB. We've had to customize, even though there's Galera supposedly out of the box supports having multi nodes and being able to handle this out of the box, it really doesn't with Docker Swarm. You really need to customize the startup and the shutdown to really check to make sure, are the other nodes actually ready for requests? Am I really safe to shut down now before? And like with Solr in particular, you'll sometimes see the errors in the logs like, am I the leader? I'm not sure yet. Can I? And it really should be like forcing a leader election before it shuts itself down. So really the only times we have issues is when the containers aren't able to shut themselves down cleanly, like if the server has an out of memory error and it's like the process is just killed. And if it's not able to shut down cleanly and tell the other ones in the cluster that you need to take up the leader role and pass the baton, essentially, then that's when things get a little hairier. Thankfully, that does not happen too often, but that is, yes, that is our most difficult task to manage.
Thanks, Damien. Yeah, that's a fantastic presentation. Infrastructure. I was also struggling with the database side, and your answer just now helped. But what if all the nodes go down at the same time? So, okay, you can up, but all your database data.
Okay. We actually have documentation for when that happens. But yes, all three nodes, let's say all three nodes catastrophically went down. Of course, your catalog site would go down too. But let's say now you're recovering from that situation, you're trying to bring things up. You would look at the files and the timestamps and the, I'm getting a little technical here, forgive me, but looking at the Docker volumes, looking at the timestamps of the files and see which of the nodes shut down last because they were the one that have the most recent data in it. And that's how you would decide this is the one that should be the leader. And you can tell MariaDB Galera that this is the one that needs to be the startup node. Start up your swarm with only that Galera node. It starts up as the leader, and then you can scale it back up to get the other replicas online, acknowledging that the other one's the leader. It will sync to that one and update their data, getting from that leader role, and everybody else will come back online. We have had to do this only a couple of times, but it does work.
It's not fun.
It's not pleasant and it's very stressful. It was documented because they're like in the panic. They're like, okay, you have a documented process. We're going to go through the steps. We can do this. Deep breaths. Any other questions? Yes.
Thank you. So I was wondering, I saw Docker from server stack. Mm-hmm. Are we able to define position on if the catalog or vFind or cron services start first, or is that just at random order?
We do define that they start up on, but based on the CI. We have jobs in the CI say, like, okay, we need Zookeeper to come up before Solr comes up because Solr needs Zookeeper. We need the database to come up before ViewFind comes up. And like ViewFind needs Solr and the database to come up. So we have the CI kind of depending on all of those jobs before it starts up. And then the startup scripts and those subsequent jobs make checks to make sure the other services are up. So for example, in our ViewFind startup, it does a loop at the beginning saying, check to see if Solr is ready. And it'll just keep checking for a while. And if it fails that, then that container would eventually just shut down and your ViewFind deploy would fail in that case. And it would just do the rollback as we mentioned. So there's the safety checks in those type of scenarios to make sure that things go in the order that they need to so everything is happy.
Is it controlled by a control plane with Docker Swarm? Is that, or do you guys manage that separately?
Do at the library. It's a totally separate Git repository and deployment, but it is Dockerized, and that is all fancy CI deployed as well. Like you do a deploy, and it'll go to a review environment for you to verify the changes and to go to production. Another one of our team members really could give an amazing presentation on that because she's done an amazing job on it. But yeah, that also is completely separate from this very intentionally so that if one completely goes down, you still have at least the monitoring to tell you that it has completely gone down.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Oh, and one of them. Do you run unit integration tests on your development systems and how do you check that everything is working after a change? Yes. So we do have the CI running the unit test suite. Like typically whenever you're doing a ViewFind PR, you're going to run the unit tests and the code quality scans before, or you'll have that regret after you do the commit and you see the failed job. Like, oh, darn, I forgot something. So we do that as part of our CI as well. And then post deploy, we do the integration test to make sure that we didn't have any issues during the deploy that we have introduced. We do have a lot of tech debt in the area. We wish we wrote a lot more integration tests because anytime we do a ViewFind upgrade, I swear there's like one thing that we forgot to check, like some random little feature that we didn't look at or the styling is off. Like, we really should write an integration test for that. We want to be able to check it next time. So there's always room to improve, but we do keep building upon the tests and at least the CI does run them. So we have the infrastructure there. We'll keep building upon it. Okay, any other thoughts, questions? Yeah.
This development question, if I'm curious that yes, to find, just find, can you elaborate on what that was like? But because there's a lot of stakeholders in that, like,
yes,
how much of a headache was that? And are you happy with that?
Yes, I think we have been extremely happy with switching over to ViewFind, and we had a lot of stakeholders in the library that were not completely satisfied with the features that the EDS system had and with the amount of time it would take to get the features that they needed in the EDS system. And with us having the developers available to do customizations we needed in the ViewFind system, it just made sense for us to be able to self-host our own ViewFind instance and be able to immediately to prioritize the customizations we needed for our site. For example, like we have a custom get this button instead of just the place request button where you can click it and it has, based on the status and the location and the call number, it'll show different options for what you can do with a particular item. And so we have a whole bunch of like local customizations that are unique to our instance. And when we were trying to launch Viewfind initially, we did try and meet with various stakeholders in the library to like prioritize which features that we were going to work on first. And even if we still do, we have a committee that we meet with to help show them what we have done, but then also get feedback on what you guys think we need to work on next. What are you guys hearing from in the library that we need to prioritize? Fun part was doing the infrastructure. Don't you just love learning new tools? You're like, oh my goodness, I got an excuse to learn all the new fancy stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could ask questions for a week on this because it's just so fascinating. But it's going to be this one.
Yeah.
How do you upgrade each of these nodes so you're pushing out a new version of Viewfind that has made some changes to the database schema? Right. So there's a timing issue potentially where you want to make sure the schema is updated in each node before the UI is potentially doing anything wrong, vice versa. How do you deal with that?
Actually, not had too many major issues with doing the upgrades. It replaces the complete Docker image at the deployment time. So before Viewfind is started, it will replace the MariaDB image. Let's say like we just recently did the Solr upgrade to the 9.8. So it replaced our Solr from 9.6 to 9.8. And then all three of those Solrs were updated to that new image before the new Viewfind came online. And part of the Solr image's startup process is to copy in the new schema and the Solr config file. So the Solr is already updated and ready to go before Viewfind even comes online to see those changes. And for MariaDB, the image is replaced before even Viewfind comes online to attempt to do database updates. And right now, if I remember correctly, we're still doing the command to do the database migration changes manually after upgrades. Is that correct, Damien? I know we had it automated at one point, and then we switched it to manual. I believe that's correct. I'd have to double check it. I was thinking the other day, we should go back to making it automated now that there's the command line utility to do that database upgrade. And we tried to do like curl commands to the web interface to do the upgrade, but it was not consistently working. So like we need to take it out of the CI if it's not consistently working. So I think we did that manually for a while. So we made sure all of the prior services are all online and stable before Viewfind would come up and attempt to do its steps first, and then we would do the manual step of doing kicking off the database upgrade after that comes online. Right, there's usually not many database model changes.
I said this to Megan at breakfast yesterday, but I want to put it to the record that we're talking about all these tools. I really have to recommend Jo from National Library of Finland from Junior Air, some record exports. I promise you, it's easier doing it that way. Searching through the harvested OMI files, trying to find the right record. Put a few minutes in, we'll save a lot of time, I promise.
Yes, for the rest of you. So how we get our data in from Folio is we have an automatic harvest. So about once a semester, we do a full harvest from Folio and get our data in. And then every 15 minutes, we're doing an incremental harvest to get the change records from Folio. So we have a very, very large number of OAI files that build up on our server over time. That's why we do the full harvest to recondense that. And so when we're trying to isolate that one specific MERC record, that's why we have that handy script, because it would take us ages to go figure out which of these incremental files has the latest version of this specific instance record in Folio. And then I wonder if I can even just pull up that one.
Except very recently.
Yeah, so this is our public documentation that we maintain, mostly for our benefits, that we have the quick place to go when things break of how to immediately fix it, like how to restore MariaDB, for example, like getting the cluster redeploy, or how to safely restart the cluster without losing all of your database data. Very important. But in the, where is the, not in the first time setup. I don't think it was in the startup either. Technical overview, that guy. Yeah, this is going to be way too small. Yeah, but like, so you can kind of see like all of the data gets into our system. So we have like also backstage records from an FTP server to get our authority records. And then also from EDS, we get our HLM holding management records via FTP server. And then we still query the EDS API for that articles and more tab that we have as well. And all of this data is feeding into ViewFind. And we have a cron service that is periodically going and checking to see if there's new data. And then of course we have our get this button that's linking out to OLED for IRL requests. And we have the cover image services and Matomo externally for analytics. And then externally we have the law, everything is feeding into files that our monitoring app uses to do all of that advanced reporting on. Yes.
Yeah. I just admit it could be to go look at the harvest files for a particular record because that seemed to be what I ended up doing was just to construct a with OpenAI open. Or the IPMH with a get record verb to get the one in line. Like your version, that those the records are already there. So you don't have to go back and give it again.
It's pretty handy because we have the files there. It's just a quick command that we do that it search through the files in from Windows to Windows, so it'll find in the first file, and then it'll do a command to extract just that one specific record from the file, because of course the OAI files have multiple records in them, and then put it in the specific file, and then we can import it into a specific instance.
I'm
posting all of that.
So you can get less offers, and so is there one?
We used MariaDB for other services in the library, so we were familiar with working with MariaDB in particular.
But that can be a headache that you could just host AWS as a service, software as a service.
Possibly.
6 months. Yeah, I think all main reason might be cost, but I don't actually know the cost if you
Yeah, I mean the database isn't huge. It's Solr that's huge.
Right.
I mean, as you can imagine, with their 9.3 million records and plus the 2.4 million authority and then the 6,000 course reserves. And if anyone's curious, I'll actually like show how you get to it. So. So like this is our main library website. So this is not our ViewFind instance. This is the main library website. But if I'm searching, these links are sending us over to our ViewFind instance. It doesn't send you to EDS at all. And look, we are seeing our go away because I'm not sure about your IP. Are you a bot? So that only took a couple of seconds before it verified that, yes, you're not a bot. You're okay to go through. So this is our ViewFind instance that it took you to. And then like on our homepage, you can see we've customized this too. Let me see if this is the fancy. Yeah, look, here we go. That's an example of our get this button. It doesn't have a request list option, but it shows like the links to the IRL, and this will send over the information to pre-fill out that form and do the request article scan. So this is something we actually have a PR out there for. I'll put a plug in for that if you want to review that PR. And then things that are actually available do have the place request option immediately available. All right, and we are right at time. So I'll be happy to stay on after for a few more minutes, but I will let you guys go and get lunch. Thank you all for coming. All right, bye, Nathan. I'm going to stop the Zoom.
Yeah.
All right.